April 15th, 2004, Forsyth County, Georgia. After finishing a phone call with a customer, 38-year-old Patrice Endres vanishes from the hair salon she owns, and two eyewitnesses report having seen her in the parking lot next to an unidentified individual and a blue vehicle. Nearly 18 months later, Patrice's remains are discovered in a wooded area located 6 miles away. Police look into a number of potential suspects, including Patrice's husband and a pair of convicted serial killers, one of whom confessed to the murder, but there's still no answers about who actually killed her. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we're going to be exploring a case which was featured on the newly launched reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, the 2004 murder of Patrice Endres. At the time of this recording, 6 new episodes from this reboot have just dropped on Netflix, and I may be covering some of those featured cases on the podcast sometime in the future. But in the meantime, I'm going to be exploring a case from the first batch of new episodes, which dropped back in July, as I've already received numerous requests to cover this one. The episode in question was titled 13 Minutes, because a wife and mother named Patrice Endres vanished from the hair salon she owned during the middle of a shift, and 13 minutes is the window of time between when she was last confirmed to be alive and when she seemed to go missing. There was ample evidence to suggest that Patrice was the victim of an abduction, and she would remain a missing person for nearly 18 months before her remains were found. Ever since this episode came out, most of the attention has been focused on Patrice's husband, Rob Endres, who has managed to rub everyone the wrong way with perhaps the most bizarre interview ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Patrice's son from a previous marriage, as well as many of her friends and family members, suspect Rob of being involved in her death, but he seems to have an alibi, and eyewitness accounts place another person not matching Rob's description at the salon during the time period Patrice went missing. So is it possible that Rob's behavior has clouded people's perceptions of this case and diverted attention from the real perpetrator? Well, that's just one of the questions we're going to address on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved murder of Patrice Endres. Our story begins in Georgia in 2004, and our central figure is 38-year-old Patrice Endres. Patrice lives in Cumming, a small town of around 5,000 people located in Forsyth County, alongside her 58-year-old husband, Rob Endres. The couple have been married for 7 years at this point, and also live with Patrice's 15-year-old son from a previous relationship, Delvis Wade Black, who goes by the nickname Pistol. Patrice was known for having a wild side during her younger days, and even worked as an exotic dancer for a time, but the birth of Pistol seemed to change everything, and she would turn out to be a devoted mother who had a very close relationship with her son. She decided to go to school to become a hairstylist, and it was while working at a salon when she originally met Rob, when he stopped in for a haircut. However, Patrice always dreamed about opening up a salon of her own, and she finally achieved her goal when both she and Rob purchased a building located on Georgia State Route 369 in the unincorporated community of Matt. The salon would be named Tambor's Trim and Tan, as Tambor happened to be the surname of Patrice's birth family. Patrice gradually built up a solid clientele of regular customers who appreciated her fun personality, positive attitude, and chatty nature. On the morning of April the 15th, Patrice dropped Pistol off at school before heading to the salon to open for business. At around noon, one of Patrice's customers showed up at the salon for an appointment, but even though her Chevy Tahoe SUV was still parked outside, there was no sign of Patrice. Her purse and keys were left behind on her desk, her lunch was on the counter next to the microwave, and the cash register was open and completely empty. Patrice's wallet had also been removed from her purse, but her credit cards were still in there, as well as $270 she kept hidden inside a secret compartment. While there didn't appear to be any signs of struggle or violence, the customer was still concerned enough to contact the Forsyth County Sheriff's Office and report Patrice missing. Later that afternoon, Pistol was summoned to the office at his school and asked if he could get in touch with his mother. Pistol proceeded to call Patrice's cell phone 3 times, but the calls all went straight to voicemail, and she never attempted to call him back. Throughout the day, some of Patrice's other friends tried her cell phone and only got her voicemail. At the time, Rob was working a shift as a maintenance supervisor in Conyers, a suburb of Atlanta, and he would be informed about Patrice's disappearance sometime between 2 and 3 p.m. that afternoon. The police were able to use Patrice's appointment book to put together a timeline for the morning she went missing, and it showed that she had a mostly non-stop stream of customers after she opened for business. The last known customer to have gotten a haircut from Patrice left the salon at 11:27 a.m., as phone records established that he received a call on his cell while he was leaving. The last confirmed interaction with Patrice was from another customer who phoned the salon to reschedule an appointment. She said that Patrice was unusually short with her during their conversation, and phone records would confirm that the call ended at 11:37. The next call to the salon came in at 11:50, but there was no answer, so it seemed likely that something happened to Patrice during that 13-minute window. One of the most troubling details was the positioning of her Chevy Tahoe SUV, as it was parked near the front door facing in a westward direction, even though Patrice ordinarily backed her SUV into a spot next to the side of the building. In the earliest stages of the investigation, the media coverage was dominated by accounts of an eyewitness sighting from a motorist who claimed she saw Patrice's SUV parked next to a white cargo van before an unidentified man in his late 30s or early 40s walked around the van and entered through the driver's side. But it would later turn out that this witness completely fabricated her story, and she would be charged with making a false statement to police. However, there were 2 other eyewitness accounts from passing motorists that investigators found to be a lot more credible. They both described driving by the salon at approximately 11:45 a.m. and seeing Patrice standing outside next to a parked vehicle and an unidentified individual. Since these 2 witnesses were completely independent of each other and gave such similar stories, their accounts were deemed to be believable. But oddly, they also gave contradictory details. They each described seeing Patrice's SUV parked near the front door next to a blue vehicle, but the first witness described it as being a 1992 Chevy Lumina with a Georgia Wildlife tag, while the second witness thought it was a Ford Taurus or Malibu. The first witness also claimed that Patrice was interacting with an older woman, and they appeared to have their hands on each other, but the second witness described seeing Patrice with a man who had shoulder-length hair. Anyway, a massive search effort was launched for Patrice, which would also involve the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. It failed to turn up any trace of her, and due to Patrice's close relationship with her son, no one believed that she took off voluntarily. However, her husband Rob would immediately raise some red flags when he changed the locks on the residence the day after Patrice went missing. Pistol was out of the house at that time, and when he returned home, Rob refused to answer the door and would not let him inside to get any of his clothing or personal possessions. Even though Pistol's relationship with Rob had been good for about a year after he married Patrice, things would fall apart between them. Pistol felt that his stepfather always displayed a negative attitude towards him, while Rob believed that Patrice did not discipline her son enough. Rob would later say that his decision to change the locks was a precautionary measure, since his wife had just gone missing, and while he didn't personally like Pistol, he thought his stepson would be safer if he stayed somewhere else. Pistol was forced to go live with other family members, and he eventually moved in with his biological father. Pistol and many of Patrice's other friends and family members had their suspicions about Rob, and believed he was jealous, controlling, and possessive of Patrice. According to Pistol, the couple was frequently fighting, and a few weeks before she went missing, his mother told him that she was thinking about divorce. However, Rob maintained that Patrice never spoke about divorce with him, and things were fine with their relationship. Interestingly enough, before leaving her house on the morning of her disappearance, Patrice left a note on Rob's car which read, quote, "The best is yet to come," though it's never been made clear what this message meant. Rob was interviewed and thoroughly investigated by the authorities, and seemed to have an alibi during the time period Patrice went missing. Rob claimed that he spent most of the morning at home, before he drove to the town of Woodstock, which is about a 45-minute drive from Patrice's salon, and he even provided a time-stamped receipt which showed he got gas there. Rob then headed to his workplace in Converse, and a turnstile logged in the time he arrived there. According to investigators, while the timeline of Rob's whereabouts did not completely eliminate him as a suspect, it made it less likely he could have been responsible for Patrice's disappearance. Well, the investigation went head in another direction in March of 2005, when a suspect named Jeremy Jones confessed to Patrice's murder. At the time, Jones was in custody for two other murders, as he had originally been arrested for the brutal rape and murder of 45-year-old Lisa Nichols, which took place in Turnerville, Alabama, on September the 18th, 2004. Jones had shot the victim before setting her on fire in her bathroom, and it wasn't long before Jones was also charged with the murder of 16-year-old Amanda Greenwell, who had been Jones's neighbor at a mobile home park near the town of Douglasville, Georgia. Amanda originally went missing in March of 2004, before her decomposed body was found in a wooded area the following month, and it turned out she was stabbed and strangled to death. Douglasville was located over 60 miles from Patrice's salon, and Jones would tell investigators that he was responsible for her abduction and murder. Jones claimed that he had gotten lost while driving that morning because he was high on methamphetamine, and he just happened to come across Tambor's Trim and Tan. When he noticed that Patrice was alone there, he went inside and asked her if she would give his car a jump. Patrice agreed to do so and moved her SUV out of her usual parking spot, but Jones responded by pulling out a knife and forcing Patrice into his car. After driving over 60 miles into Douglas County, Jones proceeded to rape and murder Patrice before taking her body to the Riverside Parkway Bridge above Sweetwater Creek and dumping her into the water. At the outset, investigators found Jones's confession to be credible because he drew an accurate diagram of the salon and the position in which Patrice's SUV was parked. However, an extensive search of Sweetwater Creek failed to turn up any trace of Patrice. After being convicted of Lisa Nichols' murder at trial, Jones was officially sentenced to death on November the 29th, 2005, but just over 1 week later, there would be a major development in Patrice's case. On December the 6th, some workers doing construction at the Lebanon Baptist Church in Dawson County, Georgia, went into a wooded area behind the church and discovered a human skull. When police were notified, they performed a more extensive search of the woods and soon came across more skeletal remains. It wasn't long before dental records positively identified the skull as belonging to Patrice Endress. The location was approximately 6 miles away from Patrice's salon, and she was officially missing for 600 days before the discovery, but her official cause of death has never been made public. When she vanished, Patrice had been wearing her wedding ring, which consisted of two bands soldered together with a Marquise diamond in the center, and it had the inscription, "Patrice and Rob Forever," but it was not found with her remains, and it still never turned up. It wasn't long before Jeremy Jones completely recanted his confession about murdering Patrice, claiming that he made up the whole story in order to get better food and extra privileges in jail. Years later, investigators would turn their attention towards another convicted murderer named Gary Michael Hilton, who was originally arrested in January of 2008 for the murder of 24-year-old Meredith Emerson. On New Year's Day, Meredith went missing after she left her home in Buford, Georgia, to go hiking on a trail on Blood Mountain. At some point, she crossed paths with Hilton, who proceeded to abduct Meredith and hold her captive for 3 days before bludgeoning her to death with a carjack handle and decapitating her. After Hilton was arrested, he made an arrangement with the authorities to plead guilty to Meredith's murder and led them to her remains in exchange for taking the death penalty off the table. It turned out that Meredith's remains were in the Dawson Forest Wildlife Management Area, around 10 to 15 miles from the location where Patrice's remains were found, so Hilton was looked at as a potential suspect in her case. Records showed that Hilton had been stopped for a traffic violation in Forsyth County during the approximate time period when Patrice was abducted, and he did not seem to have an alibi on that particular date. Hilton also liked conning people out of money, both in person and over the phone, and during one interview with police, he stated that his favorite spot to do this was at hair salons. Well, Hilton has since been linked to 3 additional murders, marking him as a full-fledged serial killer, investigators have never found any evidence linking him to Patrice's death. Following the discovery of her remains, Patrice would be cremated and her ashes given to Rob. To this day, Pistol claims that Rob has never allowed him access to the ashes or any of his mother's personal possessions or photographs. Patrice's story would be featured on the reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, which launched on Netflix on July 1st, 2020, but for the moment at least, there's still no conclusive answers about who actually killed her. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, as I'm sure you're all aware, one of the most popular tropes in the true crime genre is the husband did it, and well, during his appearance on Unsolved Mysteries, a number of people believed that Rob Endress was such a poster child for this trope that it almost crossed the line into self-parody. I've already shared a number of details which do not paint Rob in a flattering light, but some of the things he said during his Unsolved Mysteries interview were jaw-dropping. In case you've never seen the episode, Rob emotionally recalls how after Patrice's remains were delivered to the funeral home, he asked the staff to reassemble her and lay out the bones for him. Rob then said he proceeded to pick up Patrice's skull and carry it around for a while before he kissed her goodbye. As if that wasn't enough, after Rob received Patrice's ashes, he admits right on camera that he slept and snuggled with them because she was, quote-unquote, like my teddy bear. He then proceeds to go into his closet and pulls out a cardboard box containing the ashes and shows them to the camera crew. Well, after this episode came out, it wasn't long before Rob was the subject of a number of memes online and became the true crime community's most popular whipping post since Carol Baskin from The Tiger King. But the unfortunate side effect is that all this focus on Rob's weirdness seemed to distract from the actual victim in this case, Patrice, and may have clouded people's judgment. Of course, the original Unsolved Mysteries featured interviews with a number of spouses who were suspected of being involved in the murder or disappearance of their other half, and they often did a less than convincing job of appearing on camera to proclaim their innocence. Of course, one of the most infamous examples is Jewel Kaler, who was interviewed in the very first Robert Stack-hosted episode about the disappearance of his wife, Dottie Kaler, and openly said that even though she is still missing, things are really pretty good for him. But I think even Jewel would have drawn the line at admitting he kissed his wife's skull and cuddled up in bed with her ashes. Rob also displayed questionable behavior outside his Unsolved Mysteries interview, particularly when it came to the terrible treatment of his stepson Pistol. If Rob was put on trial for the crime of being a massive douchebag, then yes, I would probably have to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But is he actually guilty of the murder of his wife? Well, this is where I think the case gets more complicated. To make a comparison, I previously done my own podcast episode about the disappearance of Dottie Kaler, and even though I have virtually no doubt that Jewel Kaler was responsible for her disappearance, it's not because he acted like a jerk during a TV interview. It's because there are so many holes and discrepancies in Jewel's story that once you look at all the evidence as a whole, the only logical conclusion you can reach is that he did it. But Rob Endress appears to have a fairly solid alibi, and multiple eyewitnesses have placed Patrice with other individuals who do not match Rob's description right before she went missing, so the solution to this case is definitely not cut and dried. In the years following Patrice's disappearance, her case received a lot of press in the local media, particularly the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and it's quite interesting to dig through the old newspaper articles and look at the original coverage, as it does not give off any impression that Rob was considered to be a potential suspect. I did find one article which hinted at personal friction between Rob and Pistol, as Patrice's sister stated that she would always go on vacation or visit family with either her husband or son, but never both of them together. But at no point does anyone flat out point the finger at Rob, as during his newspaper interviews, he just comes across as your typical grieving husband. Rob also seemed to be proactive during the search for Patrice while she was missing, as he offered a reward for information and was organizing fundraisers to spread the word about her case. He even went so far as to travel to Alabama to attend Jeremy Jones' trial for the murder of Lisa Nichols, and the October 27, 2005 edition of the Montgomery Advertiser showed a photo of Rob holding up Patrice's picture on the front page under the headline, "Husband Hopes Conviction Will End Mystery." Believe it or not, one person who has publicly defended Rob is Terry Dunn Muir, one of the original co-creators of Unsolved Mysteries. Muir has done a number of interviews following the reboot's release, in which she has discussed this case and expressed her surprise and disappointment with the reaction to Rob on social media. According to Muir, Rob has since gotten remarried, and she believes that Rob was honest with them during his interview and legitimately did love Patrice. Now, I don't want to make it sound like I'm defending Rob as a person, because some of his actions, such as locking Pistol out of their house the day after his mother went missing and denying him access to her ashes, are truly indefensible. I don't think I've seen too many people featured on Unsolved Mysteries that I felt more sympathy for than Pistol, who is clearly still devastated about the loss of his mother. I also don't have a hard time believing the allegations that Rob is a narcissist who is jealous and controlling of Patrice. But for now, let's move away from Rob for a while and focus on the actual circumstances of this crime. As you all know, the title of the Unsolved Mysteries episode was 13 minutes because it's believed that is the approximate window of time in which Patrice's abduction could have taken place. The last person who confirmed speaking to Patrice said she phoned the salon to reschedule an appointment before the call ended at 11:37 a.m., and it's interesting how the caller said that Patrice was unusually short with her during the conversation. Patrice was described as ordinarily being a very chatty person, and another customer who frequented the salon at around 9 a.m. also said that Patrice seemed distracted and not very attentive to her. So I have to wonder if this is an indication that Patrice had something on her mind that morning, which might support the idea that she was experiencing issues in her marriage with Rob. I also think it's possible that the person responsible for Patrice's disappearance was already in the salon during that final phone call, which is why Patrice gave off the impression that she wanted to get the call over with as quickly as possible. Since the next call to the salon at 11:50 went unanswered, this strongly implies that Patrice had already been abducted by that point, especially when you factor in the eyewitness accounts of Patrice standing outside in the parking lot at around 11:45. Now, I mentioned earlier that the earliest media coverage of this case put a heavy emphasis on an eyewitness sighting of an unidentified man in a white cargo van parked outside the salon. This detail took me by surprise during my research, since it was never mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries, but it was very disheartening to find out that this witness completely fabricated her story, and I have no idea why she would have done this, unless she was hoping to collect some reward money. I'm not exactly sure how police learned that her story was false, but it likely had something to do with the fact that two completely independent eyewitnesses reported seeing a blue car parked outside the salon, which contradicted her story. And that's quite unfortunate, because I couldn't find any mention of the blue car in the older newspaper articles, likely because investigators wasted so much time chasing down the false lead with the van. If the public had been made aware of the blue car much earlier, who knows if things might have turned out differently. Now, I have frequently talked about the fallibility of eyewitness testimony on numerous episodes of the podcast, and this case is a perfect reminder of it. Technically, the two separate witnesses who drove by the salon and saw Patrice outside next to a blue car were likely correct about the basics, but they contradicted each other on certain details. One witness said the car was a Chevy Lumina, while the other thought it might be a Ford Taurus or Malibu. I can understand that discrepancy, because it's not like those vehicles look drastically different from one another, but what's really strange is that one of the witnesses thought she saw Patrice next to an older woman, and the other mentioned a long-haired man. I guess it's possible that because of the long hair, the first witness could have mistaken a man for a woman, though if Patrice's killer was female, that throws the case in an entirely different direction, especially since the witness thought she saw the two women placing their hands on each other. Given the narrow time frame, it seems unlikely that these two witnesses could have passed by the salon at different times and seen Patrice next to two different people with two different cars. I guess it's possible that the individual with the blue car had nothing to do with Patrice's murder and just stopped by to ask for directions or something and subsequently left before the real perpetrator arrived. However, both witnesses placed their sightings at around 11:45, and given that the phone call with no answer came in at 11:50, and a customer arrived to notice that Patrice was missing at noon, the time frame just seems way too narrow, so Patrice was probably abducted only minutes, if not seconds, after the witnesses drove away. But regardless of whether the unidentified individual was a man or woman, they most definitely did not match the description of Rob Endress, who was bald, unless he just happened to be wearing a wig to disguise himself. And while I have no idea what type of vehicle Rob drove at that time, if he could be linked to a blue Lumina, Taurus, or Malibu, I'm sure the authorities would have said so. There are definitely some unanswered questions about the circumstances of how Patrice was abducted. There was cash missing from the register inside the salon, and it appears that someone took her wallet out of her purse and went through it, though it seems like they missed the $270 she had inside a secret compartment. But there's been a lot of skepticism over the idea that robbery was the primary motive for this crime, as the responsible party may have stolen the money just to make it look like a robbery gone wrong. The investigators have even said that hair salons are ordinarily not ideal targets for robberies, since they're not known for keeping a lot of cash on the premises. And of course, a lot has been made about the fact that Patrice's SUV was found parked near the front door instead of its usual spot next to the side of the building, and the two witnesses both claimed that the SUV was already positioned there next to the blue car when they drove past. This is why it's been theorized that someone could have lured Patrice outside by telling her that their car needed a jump, but shortly after she moved the SUV from its usual spot, this person took advantage of the situation and abducted her. Hell, this was the exact scenario Jeremy Jones described during his confession, which is one of the reasons the authorities initially thought it sounded believable. I do think this is a plausible theory, but the one thing I'm not sure about is why someone would have gone through the cash register and Patrice's purse if she was abducted outside the building. There has been speculation that more than one person was involved in this crime, which might provide an explanation for why we have conflicting eyewitness accounts about seeing a woman and a long-haired man with Patrice. What if they were actually two separate people who conspire to abduct Patrice together. Now, before we talk any more about the likelihood of Rob or anyone else committing this crime, we have to talk about the two convicted murderers who have been looked at as potential suspects. And appropriately enough, both these men have been considered potential suspects in other cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Throughout 2005, Jeremy Jones dominated all the news coverage of this case since he made a confession to Patrice's murder. At the time, she was still a missing person, so this seemed like a very promising lead. But since Jones said he dumped her body in a creek, which turned out to be over 60 miles away from the wooded area her remains were ultimately found, his confession lost a lot of credibility. Many people no longer believe that Jones had any involvement in Patrice's death, and even though Jones himself has recanted his confession, at least one investigator who was interviewed during the Unsolved Mysteries segment was not ready to completely rule him out, since Jones supposedly provided very accurate details about the crime scene. While his claims about luring Patrice outside by asking her to jumpstart his vehicle do seem plausible on the surface, it also doesn't sound like he provided any specific details which were not already public knowledge at that point. Most of the newspaper articles from that time period mention Patrice's SUV being parked near the front door, so Jones easily could have taken that detail and used it to formulate a false confession. Jones is currently still on death row for the murder of Lisa Nichols, and while he is undoubtedly responsible for the murders of Amanda Greenwell and a New Orleans woman named Catherine Collins, he once claimed to have killed at least 21 people over one 12-year period. But at least one of his confessions has been proven to be an outright lie, as he also claimed to have been responsible for the 1999 disappearances of Laura Bible and Ashley Freeman, two 16-year-old girls from Welch, Oklahoma, who vanished after Ashley's trailer was burned down and both her parents were shot to death. Jones claimed that he murdered the adults over a drug debt before he shot the two girls and disposed of their bodies in a mine shaft, but a search failed to turn up the remains or any evidence to support his story. I'm sure many of you are already familiar with this case and know that a suspect named Ronnie Busick was arrested for the crime in 2018 and has recently pleaded guilty to accessory to second-degree murder. Even though the girls' remains have still not been found, it's now apparent that Busick and two deceased accomplices, Warren Philip Welsh and David Pennington, were the perpetrators, and Jones had nothing to do with it. Once they have nothing left to lose, it's fairly common for convicted murderers to confess to crimes they did not commit for attention, so I'm inclined to think that's what happened here, and Jones did not kill Patrice either. Even though Gary Michael Hilton was originally arrested for the murder of Meredith Emerson and agreed to plead guilty in order to avoid the death penalty, he has since been charged and convicted of three additional murders which took place in late 2007, an elderly couple named John and Irene Bryant, and a nurse named Cheryl Dunlap. The Dunlap murder earned Hilton a trip to death row, which is where he resides today, and he's also been looked at as a potential suspect in some other cold cases, including the bizarre death of Judy Smith, which has been featured on both Unsolved Mysteries and The Trail Went Cold. As you might recall, Judy Smith vanished during a business trip to Philadelphia in April of 1997, before her skeletal remains were discovered on a mountain in Pisgah National Forest in North Carolina 5 months later. Obviously, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about how Judy made that 600-mile trip there in the first place, but since the murders of John and Irene Bryant also took place in Pisgah National Forest, there has been speculation that Hilton may have been responsible for her death, though no evidence has been found to support this. There are some tentative connections which link Hilton to Patrice Enders's case, such as the fact that her remains were found in Dawson County, which is where he murdered Meredith Emerson and disposed of her remains. Even though Hilton once made a remark about visiting hair salons to con people out of money, the problem I have with the idea of him abducting Patrice from there is that it's totally different from his usual MO, as his known crimes involve him targeting hikers, which is why he's sometimes been referred to as the National Forest Serial Killer. Furthermore, one thing the murders of Meredith Emerson, Cheryl Dunlap, and the Bryants all had in common is that Hilton stole their ATM cards and attempted to use them to withdraw money. Patrice's wallet and purse were left behind at the salon, and while it's never been specifically stated if she had an ATM card in there, there's no indication that anyone stole her card or attempted to use it. Once again, in spite of the missing money from the cash register, it's been suspected that Patrice's murder was not financially motivated, and that someone staged a robbery to cover up a more personal motive for the crime. So this leads us back to Rob, and now I'm going to talk about the things which do make him look suspicious. During his interview, Rob claimed there was no real motive for him to harm Patrice, and since she did not have a life insurance policy, he did not profit financially. But of course, if the rumors are true that the marriage was falling apart, and Patrice was planning to divorce Rob, then there's your motive. Given his supposedly controlling personality, there's a symbolic creepiness to the fact that Rob is holding on to Patrice's ash and will not let anyone else see them, as if it's his way of saying, if I can't have you, no one else will. Unsolved Mysteries did not mention that Patrice left a note on Rob's car before she went to work that morning, and I've only seen that piece of information mentioned in one article from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It read, "The best is yet to come," and I'd really be curious to know what Patrice meant by that. The note could very well have no relevance to this case at all, but if this was a message in which Patrice was conveying her intention to leave Rob, then this could have been the breaking point which set Rob off and prompted him to abduct her from the salon. While the Unsolved Mysteries episode shared the information about Patrice's wedding ring never being found, it did not mention that the words "Rob and Patrice Forever" were inscribed on there. If you believe Rob is guilty, then him holding on to that ring after all these years would totally fit his personality. To me, the biggest red flag is Rob's decision to change all the locks on his house and refusing to allow Pistol inside the very day after Patrice went missing. Rob's rationalization during his Unsolved Mysteries interview about being concerned for both his and Pistol's safety does not hold water. Even if he had personal issues with Pistol and did not want to live with him, at the very least, Rob should have allowed him to come inside and collect his personal possessions. I mean, Pistol was still a minor at the time, but Rob wouldn't even speak to him or ensure that he had another place to stay. It's terrible behavior from a moral standpoint, but it also makes no sense from a logical standpoint. Patrice had only been missing for around 24 hours before Rob changed the locks, and no one could even be 100% certain she was dead. What if Patrice turned out to be alive and returned home to find out that Rob had kicked her son out of the house? If there weren't already serious issues with the marriage before, that probably would have been the final nail in the coffin, because if there's one thing which Patrice seemed to have zero tolerance for, it was the mistreatment of her son. So you can see Rob's actions as an indication that he knew Patrice was dead and would not be coming back. A much darker interpretation is that Rob did not want anyone else to enter the house because he had incriminating evidence in there, possibly even Patrice's body. Remember, even though Patrice's remains were ultimately found in a wooded area, that doesn't necessarily mean they were placed there on the same day she disappeared. However, let's look at the actual logistics of Rob being able to commit this crime. Here's the actual quote one of the investigators said on Unsolved Mysteries when discussing Rob as a suspect. Quote, "Rob Endress was thoroughly investigated, and we created a timeline for him that doesn't eliminate him from being able to do this, but greatly reduces the chances that he could have done this. It doesn't eliminate a murder for hire, but it just doesn't seem probable. We've uncovered nothing that suggests that at this point." End quote. The only specific information about Rob's alibi was provided by him in his own interview, where he mentions having a time-stamped receipt which shows him getting gas in the town of Woodstock, and that a turnstile recorded the exact time he arrived at work. Rob states that this would have made it physically impossible for him to commit this crime, but since he hasn't been completely eliminated as a suspect, I'm guessing it's more improbable that he did it rather than outright impossible. Newspaper articles have stated that Rob worked the second shift as a maintenance supervisor in Conyers, though they did not name the actual workplace. It's also never been mentioned what exact time Rob logged in, but Conyers is located nearly 70 miles southeast of Patrice Salon. But I am very curious about Rob's claim that he got gas in Woodstock. Woodstock is a 45-minute drive away from the Salon, but it's also over an hour's drive northwest from Conyers. In other words, Woodstock is definitely not on the route from Rob's home to his workplace, and would have required him to drive several miles out of the way to get gas. I mean, I guess Rob may have had other reasons for traveling to Woodstock that day before he went to work his shift in Conyers, and I'm sure investigators probably looked into this. Whatever the case, it is hard to imagine Rob abducting and murdering Patrice, dumping her body in Dawson County, and then driving 70 miles to work his shift as normal without raising any red flags that something was wrong. The biggest piece of evidence which leans away from Rob being the perpetrator are the two eyewitnesses who saw Patrice standing next to a completely different individual in a blue car outside the Salon. If Rob did it himself, then this means he would have had to show up almost immediately after that other person left and abducted Patrice before her next customer arrived at the Salon and noticed she was missing. That doesn't seem probable, so if Rob is guilty, then the only scenario which makes sense is if he hired the individual with the blue car to kill Patrice. Rob's detour to Woodstock could be interpreted as him taking additional steps to place himself at a faraway location and fabricate an alibi. During his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Rob even made a remark about how he studied criminology, which some people have taken as a sign that he was using this knowledge to plan out the perfect murder. However, if this was a murder-for-hire plot, investigators have stated they've been unable to find anything pointing in that direction, such as, say, a large sum of money being withdrawn from Rob's bank account during this time period. Indeed, it seems very brazen that Rob would arrange for someone to abduct Patrice from the Salon during the middle of the day. Unless the perpetrator was watching the place for a couple of hours that morning, it seems like they got incredibly lucky to be able to pick out a window of time when Patrice did not have any customers and was alone. I guess it's possible that Rob could have seen Patrice's appointment book and known she did not have any appointments scheduled between 11:30 and 12 o'clock, but that sort of thing can change at any time, and given that this was a public place next to a highway, there's always the risk of someone stopping by. Look, I know that Rob Endress has become one of the most hated people on the internet in 2020, and there are some good reasons for that, but I just don't feel comfortable saying with 100% certainty that he was involved in this crime. If Rob was involved, he seemed to do a very effective job at covering his tracks. But on the other hand, this begs the question, if Rob didn't do it, then who actually did? While I've always wondered if we should place some significance on the location where Patrice's remains were found, the wooded area was very rough terrain, and it would have been difficult to transport her body through there, which is why investigators pushed forward the possibility that the perpetrator forced Patrice to walk into the woods before they killed her. Rob even made an odd remark during his interview about someone using a wheelbarrow to transport her body, which struck some people as strangely specific, though it could just be him proposing hypothetical scenarios. Since the perpetrator selected a location behind the Lebanon Baptist Church, you also have to wonder if they were a local who was familiar with the area. I personally lean away from the idea of Patrice being abducted by an opportunistic serial killer like Jeremy Jones or Gary Michael Hilton, who was just passing through the area. I have to wonder if it was an individual who had been inside the Salon before and was familiar with the layout, and may have even known Patrice personally. A theory I've always found intriguing is that it could have been a spouse or someone associated with one of Patrice's regular customers who developed a fixation on her. They may not have been planning to kill Patrice that day, and only showed up at the Salon with the intention of making advances towards her, but when she rejected them, things escalated into violence. And let's not forget that one of the witnesses was certain she saw Patrice and an older woman putting their hands on each other, so if the perpetrator was female, then that points to this crime being motivated by some sort of personal grudge. However, if any women have ever popped up on the radar as potential suspects, investigators have never said so. until the person or the blue vehicle seen outside the salon that day can be identified, the actual truth about what happened to Patrice will be based on nothing more than speculation. Anyway, ever since this case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, it sounds like new tips have been pouring in, so hopefully, maybe this will lead to a resolution someday. If you happen to have any information on the murder of Patrice Endres, please contact the Georgia Bureau of Investigation tip line at 1-800-597-8477. That's 1-800-597-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode in which I discussed and analyzed the famous Unsolved Mysteries Halloween special, which aired on television in October of 1988 and featured four very memorable segments about ghosts. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that for the past several months, I have been hosting live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode, and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in the show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information, or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶